Shalom, welcome to ASJTF. This is Chaim Ben Pesach. This program is dedicated to elevating the souls of Simcha Chasdai, Meir Ben Yecheskel, Pesach Ben Dov, and Yosef Ben Meir. Before we get to our many questions from our great JTFers this week, there is news. There is a new government in Israel, a new coalition agreement, and it affects our desire to eventually run a Knesset list, to eventually try to run for the Knesset with our political movement in Israel, with our Hebrew movement in Israel. Unfortunately, as part of the coalition agreement between the various parties in the new coalition government, they have decided that they intend to increase the minimum threshold you need to get Knesset representation. Right now, you have to get at least 2% of the total vote in order to get Knesset representation. You got to get 2% of all the votes cast in the election in order to have Knesset members, in order to have your party represented in the Knesset. They're planning to increase that minimum threshold from 2% to 4%. They're planning to double it. That has a big impact upon us, because if we decide to run, it would be difficult for us even to get the 2%. That's going to be hard enough. But 4%, if we ran by ourselves independently, we would have virtually no chance of being able to get 4% of the vote. 4% of all the votes in Israel in the Knesset elections for a new party without a big budget. It's not doable. It's not realistic. And so, God willing, we hope that this will not occur, but it probably will, because they've already made an agreement. The parties have already made an agreement to pass the legislation in the Knesset. So it probably will go through, although, you know, until it actually happens, you never know. God could do all types of things to prevent it. So God forbid, I hope it doesn't go through. God willing, it shouldn't go through. If it does, let me explain what the meaning of it is for our dream of running a Knesset list with our Hebrew movement in Israel. It means that we're going to have to run with other people. We can't run by ourselves independently. We will never get elected if we run by ourselves independently. Once again, let me just explain why it's so difficult for a small, minor, brand new party to get 4% of the vote. Just look at elections in America. Look at the presidential election in America, because the Knesset election in Israel is nationwide. So it's similar to the presidential election in the United States, which is also a nationwide vote. If you look at the presidential election in America, it's the same psychology. Minor parties running in the presidential election in America very rarely even get 1% of the vote. Why? Not because people don't agree with some of the things the minor parties say. There are minor parties that say things that sometimes are very popular that many people agree with. But nobody believes that the minor party has a serious chance of actually winning, of actually getting elected. And so people feel they're wasting their votes on a minor party. That's why minor parties in America very rarely even get 1% of the vote. If they get 1% of the vote, that's quite an accomplishment. The Libertarian Party, for instance, runs every 4 years. And they, I think, maybe once or twice have gotten close to the 1% vote, the 1% mark. They have been unable to even get 1% year after every 4 years, every time they run, they've been unable to do that. We have the same psychology at play in Israel. People think if you're a brand new party and you don't have a big budget, that you don't have a realistic chance of passing the minimum threshold, and so people feel they're wasting their vote on you. This is what happened with Rabbi Meir Kahana, Zecher Tzaddik V'Kadosh Livracha, Hashem Yikom Damo. Rabbi Kahana, the first three times he ran, didn't pass the minimum threshold. He lost. The fourth time he ran, he finally was able to pass the minimum threshold. Once he got in, and people saw that he was actually a member of the Knesset, then the psychology changes. Then people think, oh, this is realistic now. Now I could see this guy, you know, now I could see this guy in this party actually representing me, because they actually did pass the minimum threshold. Then the polls suddenly showed that he was getting 12 to 15 seats out of the 120 seats, that he was going to get 10% or more of the total vote. So passing the minimum threshold and actually getting in is a very important psychological barrier that you have to pass. Until you do that, it's very hard to get even 1 or 2% of the vote. Very hard. 4% is virtually impossible for a new party like ours. For a brand new party without a big budget like ours, it would be virtually impossible. The only way that we could possibly get maybe one of our people in the Knesset, the only way we could possibly do that would be if we ran in a coalition with other people. And if we bring in a certain number of people from the right and from the Kahanist movement, and then we have other people bringing in voters, only if we ran in a coalition with others would we have a realistic chance at this point. So we can't run by ourselves now. If this 4% minimum threshold passes, we're not going to be able to run by ourselves. We're going to have to run with somebody else. Now, that's quite a challenge, because how many people are going to be willing to run with us? We're controversial. I don't know how many people are going to be willing to run with us. And then we are not willing to run with just anybody. We have our principles. You know, how many people are we willing to run with that wouldn't be a violation of our principles? So it's going to be quite a challenge. It's going to be quite a challenge. We'll see what happens. But in the meantime, we still, of course, want to have the funds so that we could prepare. The stronger our budget is, the more we'll be able to offer potential coalition partners if we want to put together a party so that the party can pass the 4% threshold with other people that are in the same situation we're in. If we want to do this, we are more attractive to people, and we'll be able to appeal to people more if we have a bigger budget. So it's very important that we have as much financial support as possible. Because, you know, we've got to, if we approach other people in Israel and say, hey, let's run together, they're going to say, well, what are you bringing to the table? What are you going to bring to the ticket? And what are you going to bring to the campaign that makes it worth it for me to run with somebody like you? If we have a bigger budget, that's much more appealing. So again, our raising enough funds is going to be absolutely essential. Anyway, that's the new development in Israel. It could wind up being a blessing in disguise. It could force us to run with other people and could make us part of something bigger, you know, something bigger than just our own one little party. So it could be a blessing in disguise in the end. Who knows? I don't know what's going to be. I have no idea what's going to be yet. It's too early to know what's going to be. The next election will probably be in 2 to 4 years. So I have no idea who would be our potential partners if we could realistically run, what the situation will be, how much money we're going to have. I have no idea. I do know that the more money we have, the more support we have, the bigger we are and the stronger we are, the better our chances when the time comes, the better our chances of actually making a run and, and God willing, succeeding. I could tell you one thing. We are not going to run. We are not going to run if we feel we have no chance of winning. That we're not going to do. I mean, we could run, we could easily run a Knesset list with our Hebrew movement members. We could run a Knesset list right now in the next election, you know, with just the limited budget we have. And we'd get, I don't know how many thousands of votes, but we'd come nowhere close to winning. We would not win under the present circumstances because we don't have enough money and we're too small. We just would not get enough votes to pass the minimum threshold right now. So we've got to be in a situation where we think we have a shot at actually winning, where we think we have a chance at winning. If we don't think we have a chance of winning, we're not going to run. We're only going to run if we think we have a chance. That doesn't mean we're not going to take a chance. It doesn't mean that if we think that we have a 30% chance, a 40% chance, or 50% chance, or whatever, that we wouldn't go for it. If we think we have a chance, and I don't mean a 1% chance, I mean something, you know, somewhat realistic. If we think we have a somewhat realistic chance of possibly getting in, Then I would think that it would be worthwhile for us to try and to run. Because if we get in, if we get just even one of our people in the Knesset, that's a tremendous new plus for us. A whole new situation. A completely new situation for our movement. Our movement suddenly becomes a very important movement on the political. It would be like if JTF in the United States elected a United States senator. That's what it would be like, because there are 100 members of the U.S. Senate, right? In Israel, you have 120 members of the Knesset, and you only have one house. You don't have like in the United States, you have the U.S. House of Representatives, you have the U.S. Senate, you have two houses of Congress. In Israel, the parliament is only one house, just the Knesset, the 120 members of the Knesset. That's it, because Israel is a small country. Our getting someone in the Knesset, even one member of the Knesset, would be like our electing, the equivalent to our electing a U.S. senator in the United States. It would be a tremendous boost for our movement. Can you imagine if we had a U.S. senator associated with JTF, a JTF U.S. senator? You can imagine what the impact of that would be. So it's the same situation in Israel. That's why if we think we have a chance, we're going to go for it. If we don't, if we think we don't have a chance, if we're unable to get people to run with us and it doesn't, and it seems like we don't have a realistic chance, then we're not going to run. So it'll all depend on whether we think our chances are realistic or not. How do we make our chances realistic? How do we get to that point? The more funds we have, the more we strengthen our movement and strengthen ourselves, the better our chance of being in a position to actually run and to actually, God willing, get somebody actually elected. And I just want to briefly say, you know, Barack Hussein Obama, Yimach Shmo V'Zichro Shem Reshaim Yirkav, that evil Muslim Jew hater, is planning to visit Israel this week. And that lying animal is already being promoted by the Israeli news media. They're already telling the people of Israel that he's really a wonderful friend of Israel. You know, this is a guy who openly said that Israel has to go back to the suicidal pre-1967 Auschwitz lines, who openly said that Israel should go to borders that are only 6 to 9 miles wide. He's openly demanding that Israel commit national suicide. That's his end goal. And he stated that publicly already years ago. That's his administration policy. And the traitor news media in Israel is selling us on the idea that an individual, a Muslim Jew-hating piece of garbage like this, could be a friend of Israel, that wants Israel to commit suicide, that pressures Israel to commit suicide. That's what they define as a friend of Israel. So it just shows you how evil and sick the news media and the people that are running Israel really are. Obama is going to Israel to pressure Israel not to strike Iran, even though Iran is getting close to developing nuclear bombs. He already said on Israeli television in an interview with Channel 2 News in Israel, Channel 2 in Israel, Channel 2 on Israeli television, he already said in an interview there that, oh, we have more than a year to worry about Iran developing nuclear bombs. Well, you know, according to the Israeli intelligence and the Israeli government, we have a lot less than that. So Obama is clearly playing for time, stalling, and trying to get Israel not to act. It's a very dangerous situation. That's one of the reasons why he's going there. The second reason why he's going there, of course, is to restart this process of national suicide, to get Israel to agree to create a so-called Palestine state, to at least start the process of beginning contacts again and starting to work on this again. Very, very dangerous process. Very dangerous, because we have a very weak Israeli government. And, you know, the danger of Israel eventually agreeing to go back to those 6 to 9 mile wide borders, to the suicide borders, that is a very real danger. It's insane. It's suicidal. It would be unbelievable. But Israel has done insane, suicidal, unbelievable things so many times. We have such sick, disgusting leaders in Israel that anything is possible. And there is a real danger of this. It's not going to happen on this trip, but Obama's preparing the way for this. He's beginning the process now in his second term of preparing the way for this. God forbid. God forbid that this should happen. And the Obama visit and the threats that the Obama visit posed to Israel's survival again show why it would be so important if only we were in the Knesset, if only we were addressing the people of Israel on a regular basis, which would happen if we were in the Knesset. If only we had that power, that ability, that microphone to reach all the people of Israel, which a Knesset seat could give us. If only we had that, what a difference it would make. And one other thing I want to mention about America, because, you know, if we have a Knesset seat, we become a serious player in Israeli politics. That'll give us a lot of publicity and a lot of strength for our movement in America as well. Look at the situation in America with the sequester. And we're going to be releasing a video on this soon. But look at the sequester. The sequester is the automatic across the board so-called spending cuts that are supposed to take place. We're talking about cuts that they say are 2%, but they're not really 2% cuts. First of all, there are no cuts taking place. None. All they're doing is cutting the rate of growth. Okay? Government will continue to grow at a very rapid pace, even with the sequester over the next 10 years. Government continues to grow way above the rate of inflation. Government continues to be bloated and to grow. So it's just slightly trimming off the rate of increase in the size of government. That's what the sequester is. And look what Obama has done. He is spreading panic. He lied. He said it's the end of the world. Well, we've had the sequester now for a number of weeks. Has it been the end of the world? I mean, it's so obvious that this lying piece of garbage wants to just brainwash and convince the American people that you cannot survive. You're going to have hell on earth unless we have huge government, unless we massively expand government and increase taxes and create even bigger budget deficits. This is what Obama and the Democrat Party and the left-wing news media are trying to convince people of. And so even though these minor little cuts, really minor cuts in the rate of growth, and it's just a cut in the rate of growth, it's not a real cut because government continues to grow every year. These minor little cuts, even though they will not seriously affect or cause any pain to anybody in reality. I mean, there's no real pain involved here. This is a joke. But Obama wants to create real pain. He wants to create real pain. That's why he bluffed. And that's why now he's saying that he's going to cut back on airport controllers, and he's going to cut back on airport control towers and on TSA officials to check people at the airport. So there'll be long lines at the airports, and there's going to be chaos at the airports, and it's going to be very inconvenient. Obama is deliberately doing this. It's completely unnecessary, but Obama is deliberately doing this in order to convey a message to the American people. If you don't accept huge, big government, your life will be a nightmare. You had better demand and push for big socialist government. If we don't have big socialist government, your life is a nightmare. Obama is creating artificial crises. He's creating an artificial crisis here. In addition to that, he announced he's canceling the White House tours, which cost almost nothing, so that children from schools can't go and tour the White House anymore. He's canceling that to cause, to try to tell the American people, you see things that you thought you could take for granted, like White House tours, we got to cancel that because those mean Republicans are not allowing us to spend more money. So he's doing this. This is all phony. First of all, the White House tours cost very little. Secondly, Donald Trump and other wealthy people have already said, we'll pay for the White House tours. Don't cancel it. We will pay out of our own pockets 100% of the cost. We will underwrite the entire cost of the White House tours. Obama's ignoring that, and he's canceling the tours, again, to create artificial pain and try to create this artificial panic so that the American people feel, oh, it's the end of the world. We don't have big government. We don't have giant government growing at a huge rate every year. That's the end of the world. All of this shows just how phony, evil, and corrupt Obama, the Democrat Party, and the left-wing news media really are. They are evil, they're phony, they're corrupt, and they're liars. They deliberately create pain. They deliberately lie about government programs, deliberately lie about government spending. They are lying through their teeth to the American people. And their goal is evil. Their goal is big, bloated socialist government. We told you if this guy gets reelected, we told you that there are going to be bad consequences. And you already see what's going on with him. You see what he's trying to pull here. With the full support of the left-wing news media. We also told you that we got to boycott the left-wing news media and fight against the left-wing news media and create an alternative media. I mean, these are things that have to be done if America is to survive. And again, if we were in the Knesset and we were a major political force in Israel, I think all of our members agree that that would be a lot better for America as well, because we'd have a voice. Our movement in America would be a voice of sanity and reason and logic and truth, politically incorrect truth, which is so desperately needed now in America, so desperately needed. And so, what do we do? Well, you already know the drill. You know what we're going to ask for, and we need much more than we have now. So everybody, please get involved. If you want us to succeed, if you want our voice to be heard, if you want the truth to be told, And if you want us to eventually get into the Knesset, God willing, help us when we put videos up, when we upload videos, and when you see that I open a thread for new videos on the forum, whether they're in English or in Hebrew, even the Hebrew ones, even if you don't speak Hebrew, help us promote those Hebrew videos. They're important too. Help us with those videos. Help us on YouTube and help us on Facebook. Comment, like, favorite, share, mirror, all the different crazy terms that you have on YouTube and on Facebook. Help us promote them both on YouTube and on Facebook, both the Hebrew and the English videos. Also, the English forum. Please, only threads and only posts that are helpful to the movement. No threads or posts that cause unnecessary conflict or cause unnecessary petty fighting. That doesn't mean we can't have disagreements. We can have disagreements if they're intelligent and they're adult-like disagreements. We can have that on the forum. But we want the forum to look good. We want it to be appealing. We want it to be attractive so that people will get involved with us. And so that we attract also donors who will help us with our Knesset campaign. We want the forum to look good and to expand and become big so that we have a big movement. Help us with the English language forum. Help us with our Facebook pages as well. Become active on our Facebook pages. We have two English language Facebook pages, and then we have a third Facebook page, my personal Facebook page, Chaim Ben Pesach. You can become, it does help if you're active on our Facebook pages. You comment and post on our Facebook pages. And it does, and it certainly helps also to comment and post and put good posts and good subjects and good comments on our English language forum. Very, very important. And finally, last but certainly not least, most importantly, is our great financial problem. That's the number one problem we've always had. That's the number one problem the Kahanist movement has always had. This was the biggest problem Rabbi Kahana had. That's why when Rabbi Kahana was banned, he didn't have the resources to fight back properly. That was his big downfall. And so we need your help. We need your help financially. People, we have great JTFers who go on a regular basis with their credit cards to JTF.org, which is our English main page. They click on the donate button on top and they contribute very conveniently, very quickly. They contribute to the movement. Same thing on the Hebrew main page, hayamin.org. Please help us with that. People who do that, who want to do that with their credit card, it's very convenient, it's very quick, very helpful, and God bless the great JTFers who do that. In addition to that, we have the great JTFers who help through the regular mail, who send checks and money orders and cash donations through the regular mail to our post office box. Equally as important. God bless the wonderful JTFers who are helping us on a regular basis, generously helping us. It really makes a difference. God bless you. God bless your family and your loved ones, both in this world and in the next world, because you're giving hope. You're giving us hope that we're going to be able to put together enough resources and enough support so that eventually we will achieve our dream of getting to the Knesset, because if we get into the Knesset, then we could start finishing the job that Rabbi Kahana started. The job of finally having a sane, normal, and holy Jewish state that will be a light unto the nations and a holy nation and a nation of priests and that will bring final redemption to the Jewish people and to the righteous Gentiles. Anyway, we're going to move now to, of course, the questions from our great JTFers. But I wanted to share with you the news from this week. I think that's a major development. And, you know, we, of course, will keep you aware of what goes on if we meet people that we're going to try to have coalitions with. And if things develop, because I assume there will be news coming up in the next couple of years. There'll be lots of news coming up involving us. You know, we're always doing something. So we'll keep you aware of what's going on. And, you know, participate with us and become part of this. It's a blessed thing. What a blessed, we should all be thankful, thanking God that He gives us a chance to influence things, that He gives us at least a chance to have an impact and try to stop some of the terrible things that the evil people want to do, both in America and in Israel. I mean, that's a tremendous blessing that we have a chance to try to influence things. I don't know if we're going to succeed or not succeed, but the fact that we have a chance, it has an impact. It has an impact when we reach people and give them our message. It has an impact. How much it will succeed and how much, that depends on us. It depends on our willingness to make the sacrifices that are necessary to make a difference. Anyway, okay, let's go on now to our questions from our great JTFers. And we start off with the great Chicago Jew who writes, and I quote, Shalom Chaim, am I going to have more reasons to dislike Rand Paul? Unquote. Well, I think we have plenty right now. He's a Nazi. He's a Jew hater. He hates Israel. He wants Iran. I mean, he thinks there's nothing wrong with Iran developing nuclear bombs. His father, whose campaign he managed when his father ran for president, went on Iranian terrorist television and compared Israel to the Nazis and said that Gaza is a concentration camp and basically praised Muslim terrorists. He said they just want to throw bombs. He said they're just throwing handmade bombs. Like they're some sort of freedom fighters. I mean, this is an evil family and an evil person. And in office, look what he's done. He stopped economic sanctions. There are certain economic sanctions on Iran that would have been a lot tougher if not for him. He stopped them in the Senate. And he was the only senator to vote against the resolution blocking. He was the only senator to vote against a resolution saying that Iran should not be allowed to develop nuclear bombs. It was 90-1. He was the only senator voting against it. He just came out with a proposal on taxes that everybody should have to pay 17% income tax, which is a higher rate than the average American pays. In other words, his income tax proposal, his so-called flat tax proposal, will be a net tax increase for most Americans. That's the big conservative, the big libertarian? Are you joking? He's a sellout. He's a liar. He's an anti-Semite. And he would be absolutely catastrophic for America and for Israel and for the world. Anyway, thank you, Chicago Jew. And now we go to our good friend Eli Yitzchaki, who writes, and I quote, Hello, Chaim. What do you think is the future of the Syrian conflict? How much more time do you think is left for the murderous Assad regime? Unquote. Well, I hope that the conflict goes on and on and on. I hope as many of these Muslim Nazis kill each other as possible. I think it's good when Muslim Nazis fight each other and kill each other, and that's what you have on both sides here. Both sides are evil. Both sides are Muslim Nazis. When they kill each other, I think that's good. So I hope it goes on and on, and I hope they keep killing each other. I don't know what the future is. I don't know how much longer this is going to last. But both sides are definitely our enemies, and it's a dangerous situation because there are chemical weapons involved here. So in a situation like this, when we have that very, very dangerous combination of evil Muslim terrorists and a Muslim terrorist regime, and those that oppose the regime are also Muslim terrorists, and you have the chemical weapons, that's a situation that we really have to keep our eye on. It's dangerous, but right now, as long as they're killing each other, it's something that I think is good for us. Because let me be politically incorrect here. When evil Nazi beasts kill each other, that's good. That's good. We're happy when that happens. Baruch Hashem, and Hashem should only cause them to they should all kill each other. Bezrat Hashem, God willing. Anyway, thank you, Eli. And now we go to the great Pyramid Head fan who writes, and I quote, Dear Chaim, is marijuana as harmless as everybody says it is or not? Unquote. Oh, Pyramid Head fan, marijuana is definitely harmful. Definitely harmful. And there are studies that show that it causes all types of health problems. It is certainly a very harmful drug. I know people who took marijuana, who started smoking marijuana, became potheads, became addicted to the drug because it's physically addictive and psychologically addictive. And by the way, some people say, well, it's just psychologically addictive. Maybe it's not physically addictive. I don't know if it's physically or psychologically addictive, but psychologically addictive can be worse than physically addictive. I mean, if you're psychologically addicted to something, God forbid, that can be even more powerful and more difficult to overcome than a physical addiction. Physical addiction, you just have some pain in your stomach that you have to, or pain in your body that you have to overcome, and there's vomiting and other things. Certain drugs that you get addicted to, there's vomiting, there's dizziness, there's pain. You know, but when you do cold turkey and you get the drug out of your system, it's gone. But a psychological addiction, that in many cases can be even more powerful than a physical addiction. And marijuana is definitely psychologically addictive. And again, I know people who started on marijuana and then went on to much worse drugs and eventually became drug addicts and destroyed their lives. I know other people who just stayed with marijuana, never went on to other drugs, but became what we call potheads, meaning that they smoke joints all the time and they have to get high several times a week. They're potheads. They ruin their lives. They ruin their lives. It destroys your concentration, destroys your thinking. It is something that God gave us our human body. And our human body is holy. Our body is sacred. Our body is holy. We're not allowed to put harmful, hallucinogenic substances into our body to create a phony, artificial, so-called high. I mean, that's a terrible sin. We're supposed to use every moment that we live in this world and that we're awake and active and doing things in this world. We're supposed to use those moments to make our life meaningful, to make our place in this world and our stay in this world a positive one, to make this a better world for our fellow human beings. To put harmful hallucinogenic substances into our body? So that we have a distortion of our minds and distorting our minds and twisting our souls with these dangerous drugs? That's the worst thing we could do. And of course it's going to be harmful. Of course it's going to hurt. If I had a dollar for every pothead I've known in my life, because I grew up in a generation when a lot of people used drugs. I grew up in the 60s and 70s when drug use was very widespread. And if I had a dollar for every pothead I've known who could have been successful, who could have contributed positively to the world, I'd be a millionaire now. If I had a dollar for every person I know who ruined their lives taking drugs. Anyway, thank you, Pyramid Head fan. And now we go to our good friend Waiting for the Mother Plane to Come, who writes, and I quote, Shalom Chaim, do you think that Rand Paul could be Gog or Magog? And Gog or Magog is how we say Gog or Magog in English. I think it's Gog or Magog is how you pronounce it in English. In Hebrew, we say Gog or Magog. First of all, I don't think Rand Paul is Gog. But let me explain these two kinds. And the reason I don't think he is because it would have to be a leader who would assemble an international coalition against Israel and get the whole world into an international coalition. I don't think Rand Paul intends to do that. He intends to do very harmful and dangerous things. But I don't think he's into creating one world government. I don't think that's his objective. Again, the other things he wants to do are also very, very dangerous and evil. But let's explain the concept of Gog and Magog. I think it's an interesting concept, and I think it's something that people may want to know more about. First of all, there are a number of places in the Tanakh, in the Bible, where this is mentioned. It's mentioned by Yechezkel HaNavi. Yechezkel HaNavi is the prophet Ezekiel. It's mentioned by the prophet Zechariah. It's mentioned in the second psalm of David HaMelech, the Psalms of David, the second psalm. So there are certain places where references are made to the wars, because it could actually be several wars, of Gog and Magog. Gog, by the way, is not a country. Gog is the president of the country. And the actual word in Hebrew that's used in Ezekiel is Nasi. Nasi in Hebrew means president. He'll be the president. He'll be the leader of the country, Gog. And the nation is called Magog. So in other words, the evil nation that's going to be leading this international coalition, the nation is called Magog, and the leader of the nation is called Gog. Now, let's understand something. The numerical value, it's called Gimatria in Hebrew. Every letter has a numerical value in Hebrew. Every letter has a specific numerical value, which is one of the breathtaking, magnificent aspects of Bible study in Judaism. It's just incredible if you put together what these numerical values are and what the meaning of the words are, because it's a whole different way of reading the Bible. It's a deeper understanding of the Bible when you understand Gematria. Gog u-Magog, which means Gog and Magog in Hebrew. Gog u-Magog is 70. You put all the letters together, it adds up to 70 in Hebrew. 70. There are 70 nations of the world, according to Judaism. Judaism believes that, even though I know nowadays we have maybe 200 some odd countries that call themselves independent, in reality, there are 70 different nations or peoples in the world, according to Judaism. Judaism refers to the nations of the world as 70. So Gog, the leader of Magog, is going to lead a coalition with virtually the entire world on his side. Virtually the entire world is going to join him. And they're going to go to war to destroy Israel. Of course, they're also going to persecute the righteous Gentiles. Naturally, the righteous Gentiles who support Israel would also be persecuted, would also be under attack. Now, it says that this is going to happen. If you read the prophet Ezekiel, it says this is going to happen once Israel is recreated and regathered. It says in the prophet Ezekiel, as it says over and over in the Bible, that God is going to gather the Jews from the four corners of the earth. He's going to gather them from every nation, which, of course, we saw in our time. We saw this happen in our day. We've seen this incredible fulfillment of biblical prophecy already in the regathering of the exiles in Israel. So the Jews are going to be gathered from all over the world. They're going to be back in Israel. And then we're going to face this situation where you're going to have people who don't like the idea that the Jews are back in their homeland and that they're creating a Jewish state, that feel threatened by the idea that the Jews now and biblical culture and biblical values and the culture that God wants to establish through his people, that this is going to be something that's going to be part of the world. People who feel threatened by that are going to want to destroy Israel and want to go to war with Israel. Now, we also believe that this terrible war can be avoided if we do what God commands. There's a rule that Harambam, Maimonides in Hebrew is called Harambam, one of the great Talmudic commentators. Harambam teaches us a very important rule. Prophecies that are good will always come true. If there's a prophecy and God promises us something good, that will always happen, no matter what. That will happen. God, because of his love and his compassion, will always bring true and fulfill eventually his good prophecies. Eventually, every good prophecy in the Bible is going to come to pass, is going to come true. Bad prophecies, on the other hand, do not always come true. Bad prophecies can be avoided. Bad prophecies can be avoided if people do the right thing and heed the warnings of the prophets and don't do the things that they're forbidden to do. So you may say, well, that's rigging the rules. You mean just the good prophecies are automatically, they will all happen, but the bad prophecies not necessarily. Yes, God rigs the rules for us because God is not just a God of justice. He's also a God of love and compassion. And so, yes, the rules are rigged in our favor in terms of that. Bad prophecies don't have to come true. So this terrible war can be avoided. If the Jews and if the righteous Gentiles do what they're supposed to do, it can be avoided. But if they don't, then the war will come to pass. Anyway, that's just some commentary on Gog and Magog. And again, I don't think Rand Paul is planning to leave this. By the way, could be I'm wrong. It could be that he just says that he's against internationalism and so on and so forth. It could be that, that in the end, he turns into the big internationalist despite what he's saying. Because we do know that he's a liar. I mean, we do know that, you know, that he has a long history of being anti-Israel, anti-Semitic, and a long history of betraying principle, a terrible history. So if he's lying on that, maybe he's lying on the other things as well. So anything is possible. Anything is possible. But my guess is that Gog will not be Rand Paul. That's just my guess. Anyway, thank you, Waiting for the Mother Plane. And now we go to the fantastic Da Vinci, who writes, and I quote, "If Obama goes on with the spending, will there be a sudden crash like the Wall Street crash of 1929, or will there be a continuous economic decline?" Unquote. Great question. I think it's going to be one of the two. I think it's going to be one of the two. There may be just a continuous economic decline. Or, in other words, we just never really get out of the economic bad situation that we're in. We never have a real recovery, and things just go down and down and down. Or we could have a gigantic crash and another depression. That's also possible. Da Vinci, I saw something very disturbing in the past few days. There was an agreement with Cyprus. Cyprus has very severe debts, and they got a bailout from the European Union. And as part of the bailout agreement, they're going to be taking money out of people's bank accounts. People who have money in Cypriot banks are going to get some of their money taken out of the account. Some of the depositors in the bank, just so you have money in the account, they're going to take a portion of your money out to help pay for Cyprus's debt. That's part of the agreement here. So they're attacking people's bank accounts now. That could cause a run on the banks. That could cause a bank panic. And, you know, one of the causes of the Great Depression in the 1930s was a run on the banks. I mean, this is just, it's just crazy what they're doing. To take money out of people's bank accounts? To forcibly just take money out of someone's bank account? You know, that's completely nuts. Instead of just cutting back on spending and eliminating socialism. All you have to do is just eliminate socialism and stop spending so much damn money. Instead, now they're attacking people's bank accounts in Cyprus. So this could cause a panic. So there are all types of things that are happening that create real dangers. That create real dangers here. Let's hope, God willing, that, you know, that God is merciful toward us, and that you know, that we don't have to go through a Great Depression. Anyway, thank you, Da Vinci. Great questions. And now we go to the great Binyamin Yisrael, who writes, and I quote, "Is Hillary Clinton the lesser of the evils in a presidential election with her versus Rand Paul? If you're already voting, is it better to vote for Clinton than Paul?" Unquote. I would not support Hillary Clinton, Binyamin Yisrael. I will not support Hillary Clinton. She is a vicious, evil, dangerous America hater and Jew hater and a leftist, and she will do terrible things as president. She will continue Obama's terrible policies, and I would not support her. And I would not support Rand Paul either. I mean, I probably would recommend that we just sit the election out if that happens, because I will not support either one of them. Anyway, thank you, Binyamin. And now we go to our good friend Kahana Was Right. Kahana Was Right BT, who writes, and I quote, "Chaim, how could the Tekuma faction in Habayit HaYehudi, including Harav Lior, praise Bennett for his pact with Lapid? Isn't Lapid a Jew hater?" Unquote. Yes, Yair Lapid is a Jew hater. He hates the Jewish religion. He hates religious Jews. That's anti-Semitism. To hate the Jewish religion and hate the religious Jews is anti-Semitism. I think it's pathetic that the Habayit HaYehudi, which means the Jewish house, the Jewish home in Hebrew, I think it's pathetic that they have this alliance with him. They have a pact with someone like Yair Lapid from Yesh Atid. I think it's really, really, it's just unbelievable. It doesn't, I say it's unbelievable, I shouldn't say that. It doesn't surprise me, because these are the people from the old Maftal, the old National Religious Party, and the old Mizrahi movement. These are the people who were part of the Yesha Council, who sold the Jews out in Gush Katif. When Theodore Herzl, more than 100 years ago, proposed that we have a Jewish state in Uganda, that we give up the whole land of Israel and just have a Jewish state in Uganda, these people voted in favor. They called themselves religious Jews, and they were going to have the Jewish state in Uganda. So it doesn't really surprise me that much. Now, you mentioned Harav Dov Lior, who really is a great rabbi. I think he's just making a terrible mistake here by supporting them. I think he's making a terrible mistake. I hope someday when we run a Knesset list, you know, I hope that he would seriously consider supporting us. I don't think until we get into the Knesset, I don't think he would support us, because he tends to go with people who are already in power, unfortunately. But once we're already in, if we start to gain power, I do think eventually he would support us. Anyway, And he is a good rabbi, Rabbi Dov Lior, despite the fact that he's making I think he's making a mistake here. He is basically a good rabbi. And there are people who support this party who are just wrong, who are just making a terrible mistake. And that's why I want very much that we offer an alternative to this. Anyway, thank you, Kahana was right. And now we go to the great 112, who writes, and I quote, "Does Israel deserve the lies about the supposed horrible things they do to terrorists because they will not treat them as the enemies they are?" Unquote. Well, 112, Israel and the Jewish people deserve a lot of things. But we still love our fellow Jews, and we pray that God have mercy on them. They deserve a lot of things. I mean, we all deserve a lot of things. None of us are living up to what we should really be living up to in this generation. Basically, I think what 112 is asking is because they're behaving like this, aren't they getting what they deserve? Because they don't treat the terrorists like enemies, so aren't they getting what they deserve in terms of everybody accusing them? But you make a good point in one respect. You make a very good point in that the Jews bend over backwards to kiss the behinds of their murderous Nazi enemies and release their murderous Nazi enemies. For instance, the murderers of Rabbi Kahana's son, Binyamin Kahana, Zecher Tzaddik Livracha, and his wife, Talia, Zecher Tzadeket Livracha. Binyamin and Talia Kahana were both murdered in cold blood by Muslim terrorists, and their murderers were released. Their murderer, the person who, the Arab terrorist Nazi who murdered them in cold blood, was released. He was released along with 1,000 other terrorists in exchange for that left-wing traitor Israeli soldier, Gilad Shalit, who is a traitor, by the way, and is a leftist. He was released in exchange for that one soldier. They released 1,000 terrorists, including the murderers of Binyamin and Talia Kahana. Israel does some terrible things. Now, the leaders of Israel, the traitors, the actual traitors who rat on their fellow Jews, who hand over Jewish territory to our enemies, who do terrible things to their fellow Jews, those people, I'm not speaking about them. We don't love those types of people. Really wicked traitors we don't love. But the average Jew, many of the Jews over there in Israel who don't know what's going on and who foolishly support people and policies and don't really know what's going on, those people, even though they're foolish in many cases, we still love our fellow Jews. Those people we do love, and we've got to try to change them. We've got to try to wake them up. Anyway, thank you, 112. And now we go to the great ex-Muslim. Ex-Muslim writes, and I quote, "Michael Mohammed Knight, white American convert to the Nation of Islam, and preaches that all whites are devils. Comments," unquote. Well, this is a really sick, you can't get sicker than this. You know, all whites are devils, and he himself is white. Yeah, I saw something about this guy. I think I read an article about him about a year ago or something like that. But he really is a very, very sick person. Just, a sick animal. And how it started with him? I think it was hip-hop or rap. He heard hip-hop or rap, so-called music, praising Muslims and praising Islam. And so he decided to convert to Islam when he was a teenager. He was so influenced by it, he decided he wants to convert to it, even though they say that he's a devil because he's white. I mean, what a sick, sick society we have. Just completely insane. Anyway, thank you, ex-Muslim. And now we go to our good friend Selhar, who writes, and I quote, "Should Israeli regulators allow the Canadian Potash Corp to take over Israel Chemicals, which is the second largest corporation in Israel," unquote. Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Foreign takeovers of major Israeli corporations is very dangerous for Israel. This is one of the ways that you have foreign corporations controlling Israeli society, the Israeli economy, and we're talking about chemicals and things that are essential to the functioning of Israeli society and of the state of Israel. Absolutely not. Absolutely not. We would not allow foreign companies to come in and basically take over Israel's economy and hold a stranglehold over the people of Israel. No, I think it's a terrible policy to allow that to happen. Anyway, thank you, Tselhar. And now we go to the wonderful British Sword, our good friend, who writes, and I quote, "The way the world is going, do you think hell is going to be very overcrowded?" Unquote. Oh, I always thought hell is going to be very overcrowded. Of course it's going to be overcrowded. Most people will go to hell. Most people will. Most people are evil. I'm sorry, but it's true. Most people are evil. And it's not, you know, they themselves chose it at their own free will. They don't care about other people. They don't care about their fellow human beings. They're cruel. They're selfish. They're disgusting. And no matter what you, and most people, no matter what you say to them, they're going to continue to be like that. So, you know, we know what's going to happen. We know what's going to happen. Yes, there are going to be a lot of people in hell. Unfortunately, there will be. Anyway, thank you, British Sword. A very good question, as always. And now we go to Maimonides, who writes, and I quote, "Shalom Chaim, what do you think about Ted Cruz helping Paul Rand carry out his filibuster?" Unquote. Okay, great question, Maimonides. Of course, I'm not happy with anybody helping Rand Paul with anything. However, I think Ted Cruz was trying to ride a little bit on the, you know, trying to get he was trying to get some political benefit out of this as well. However, Ted Cruz, I still think, so far has been a pretty good senator, and so far he's been better than all the rest, in my opinion. We're going to be doing a video soon where we're going to be showing some of his confrontations in the Senate. And I really think he's been quite effective. And generally speaking, I'm impressed with Ted Cruz. Now, if you asked me what Ted Cruz should have done, Ted Cruz, if I had been running Ted Cruz's Senate office, if I had been his chief of staff, I would have said, Ted, you should be doing the filibuster. He should have done the filibuster before Rand Paul and should have done it with Chuck Hagel. What Rand Paul wound up doing for the CIA nominee, Ted Cruz should have done that against Chuck Hagel. Ted Cruz did oppose Chuck Hagel's nomination, but he didn't filibuster it. He should have filibustered his nomination. You know, of course, Rand Paul, of course, voted in favor of Chuck Hagel's confirmation as defense secretary. But Ted Cruz should have filibustered Chuck Hagel. He should have filibustered the CIA nominee. Ted Cruz should be the one in the forefront of all of this, instead of allowing Rand Paul to pick this one issue where he filibustered from the left, because he really filibustered from the left here. Ted Cruz should have been out there filibustering from the right. And hopefully he will do things like that. I'm hoping. I'm hoping he doesn't disappoint us. Anyway, thank you, Maimonides. And now we go to Filipino Zionist, who writes, and I quote, "If you had a government intelligence job like Jonathan Pollard, and you had intelligence regarding Israel, would you do the same thing that he did?" Unquote. I think this is a trick question. This is your first post, and you're asking me a question like this to try to get us into hot water here. I mean, either you're foolish for asking the question, or you're deliberately trying to get us into hot water here. So the only thing I'm going to say is, I'm not going to say what I would or would not do. The only thing I would say is this. Jonathan Pollard helped the United States of America. He helped America. He didn't have intelligence regarding Israel. He had intelligence regarding Muslim terrorists whom America has been appeasing. America has been appeasing these Muslim terrorists and Muslim terrorist regimes. That's the information he passed over. And the fact that Israel got their hands on that information and were able to take action against Muslim terrorists, was good for America. Pollard saved American lives. He not only saved Jewish lives and Israeli lives, he saved American lives by what he did. What he did was good for America. Anyway, let's move on now to Say No to Islam, who always has great questions. Say No to Islam writes, and I quote, one, comments on Argentina's Juan Perón and France's Charles de Gaulle, unquote. Well, Juan Perón and Evita Perón, his wife, were Nazis. You know, they supported the Nazis. They gave refuge to Nazi war criminals after World War II. They were Nazis. And there are a lot of Nazis to this day in Argentina. They're a nation filled with anti-Semites, even though you have a large Jewish community in Buenos Aires, in the capital of Argentina. I think the Jews are crazy for living there, but what can I say? But Perón was, Juan Perón was a supporter of Hitler and the Nazis, and so was his wife Evita Perón. Charles de Gaulle of France. Well, Charles de Gaulle, what a phony he was. What a phony. He cut off all, France was selling weapons to Israel before the 1967 Six-Day War. Charles de Gaulle cut off all weapon sales to Israel to protest the fact that Israel defended herself in the 1967 Six-Day War. And just to show you what a slime he was, Charles de Gaulle, and this is, by the way, the Israel that we used to have. Here's the old Israel, the Israel we used to have of the Six-Day War, the Israel that we will bring back if we ever take power. We're going to bring back this, the Israel that I'm going to describe to you now. Listen to this heroic story. Charles de Gaulle and the French announced they're not going to sell Israel Mirage jets, even though Israel paid for the jets. Israel paid, and the French said, we're not selling, too bad. The French took the money, pocketed the money, and said, now you're not getting the jets, and wouldn't give Israel a refund. So, what did the Israelis do? The French were bringing the jets from one port to another. The Israelis on the seas took the jets, hijacked the jets, and brought them back to Israel. The jets that they had already paid for, bought and paid for. So the Israelis got the jets after all and humiliated these French Jew haters. But that happened under Charles de Gaulle. That was the Israel of the Six-Day War of 1967, of Entebbe. That was a different Israel in those days. And even then, there were many problems with Israel. There were many problems even then, no question about it. They should have thrown the Arabs out. They should have done all types of things after the Six-Day War. So there were many problems even then. But at least it was an Israel where you had miraculous victories and heroism and all types of incredible things that happened. That Israel of the miraculous victories, of winning wars in 6 days, of spectacular actions like this, like on the high seas, they grabbed those French planes that Israel bought and paid for. They grabbed the planes and brought them back to Israel. These types of actions created an image for Israel that was just nothing short of spectacular. And that we will bring back to Israel if we take power. Say No to Islam now writes, two, why is Hollywood using that untalented chimp Samuel Jackson so much, unquote? Because, you know why, because Hollywood likes untalented chimps. I mean, Hollywood likes evil, vicious, vulgar, disgusting, nasty, jealous, inferior pieces of affirmative action garbage. That's what Hollywood likes. Samuel Jackson is an evil, nasty, vulgar, disgusting piece of affirmative action filth. And Hollywood loves those types of people. Those are the type of people Hollywood loves to champion. Anyway, thank you, Say No to Islam. And now we go to our good friend Tag Mechir Tzedek, who writes, and I quote, Shalom. Can you talk about and publicize the fact that we can and should halachically bring the Korban Pesach today even without the Beit HaMikdash, unquote. Okay. Just to translate here, what Tag Mechir is saying is that we should bring the Passover sacrifice now, even though we don't have the Holy Temple. And yes, we are allowed to make the Passover sacrifice without the Holy Temple. This is not like the other sacrifices. The other sacrifices, we have to have the Holy Temple in order to make the other sacrifices. But the Passover Korban, the Passover sacrifice, we do not need the Holy Temple for that one. And there are a number of reasons for that. One of the reasons is because the main aspect of Pesach, of Chag HaPesach, of the holiday Pesach, the main aspect of it is the Korban. In other words, the main thing that we have on the Passover holiday is not eating matzot. People think Jews think it's the main thing is we eat matzah. That's not the main thing. It's important. I'm not saying it's not important, but the main aspect of the Passover holiday is the Passover sacrifice, the Korban. That's the main aspect of the holiday. Secondly, the Passover sacrifice is not like other sacrifices. Other sacrifices, the Kohanim, HaKohanim, the priests, eat the sacrifices. In the Passover sacrifice, all of Israel eats the Passover sacrifice. So this is something that involves all of Israel. It's not dependent upon the HaKohanim, the priests. So we don't need the priests in the Holy Temple to do this for us. It's a different situation here. Also, we don't need the priest to make the sacrifice. And the sacrifice does not have to be made in the Holy Temple. It can be made in Jerusalem it should be in the vicinity of Beit HaMikdash, outside the Holy Temple, but as long as it's in the vicinity of the Holy Temple, that's good enough. The sacrifice can be made. And also, with the other sacrifices, you have to purify yourself before making the sacrifices because you've got to go to the Holy Temple. You have to purify yourself. You can't have tumah. Tumah means impurity, ritual impurity. With the Passover sacrifice, it's not like that. With the Passover sacrifice, you can make the sacrifice even if there is tumah. Even if there's ritual impurity, you're allowed to make the Passover sacrifice. And the main mitzvah in making the actual sacrifice, the main mitzvah is different from other sacrifices as well. The main mitzvah means commandment. The main commandment in making the sacrifice is different from other sacrifices. Because in other sacrifices, the main mitzvah, the main commandment, is to actually make the sacrifice and then put it on the altar. To put the sacrifice on the altar and make the sacrifice on the altar at the Holy Temple. In this case, the main mitzvah is, number one, the actual sacrifice. Actually, the kosher shechita, the kosher slaughter of the animal. And then secondly, eating the animal. After it's been, after it's been slaughtered and cooked, after the animal has been cooked, eating the animal, that is the main aspect of this sacrifice. The eating of the animal is more important than slaughtering it on an altar, which would be the main purpose of the other sacrifices. So there are some big differences between this sacrifice and the other sacrifices, differences that are clearly delineated both in Torah Shebe'al Peh and Torah Shebichtav. Torah Shebichtav is the written Torah, the first five books of Moses in the Bible, and Torah Shebe'al Peh is the oral Torah. And we see clearly all of the differences I just delineated are spelled out there, and that's why it is indeed doable, and we should be making the Passover sacrifice once again. If we can, people that wish to do that in the vicinity of the Holy Temple, it is worthwhile for us to do that once again. Yes. Thank you, Tag Mechir Tzedek. Okay, let me just check something here quickly. Okay, I just wanted to see something. That's good. And now we go to the great Ruby Stars, who writes, and I quote, Chaim, could you please talk about globalism and Agenda 21 and the danger these pose to us all, unquote. Absolutely. Absolutely. Very important question. Agenda 21 is a UN plan that's been around for about 20 years now. And it refers to 21. The reason it's called Agenda 21 is because it refers to the 21st century. It's supposed to be an agenda for the 21st century. And basically what this UN plan does is impose UN rules on sovereign countries, on sovereign nations. In other words, the United States, European countries, Israel, they have to follow the UN rules, whether it's in regard to the environmental issues or whether it's in regard to the economy. The UN now decides, according to Agenda 21, what to do. And many local governments, many many states, cities, and municipalities in the United States have accepted this. They've said, we're going to do what the UN tells us to do now. Believe it or not, I don't know how many people even do, how many of our fellow JTFers even are aware that this is what's happening, but it's incredible but true. Incredible but true. We have the UN already telling many states and local governments what to do, what their policies have to be, who are already part of Agenda 21. They've already signed on to this. They've already agreed to this. So, of course, if we're going to have the UN telling us what to do, we're going to lose our sovereignty. That means we have to open our borders. There are no more borders. There are no more laws or rules. Our courts will be international courts. We won't have our own court system eventually. Little by little, you'll see an erosion of national sovereignty. It's actually not little by little. It's happening pretty quickly. Very, very dangerous. Very, very dangerous. And yes, it's something we should be concerned about. Absolutely. Anyway, thank you, Ruby Stars. And now we go to the fantastic EB22, who writes, and I quote, please offer your thoughts about which person or people had the greatest positive influence on shaping Rabbi Kahana's opinions, unquote. EB, I actually think that Rabbi Kahana's opinions were shaped mostly by people in ancient times, not from the generation he lived in, not from his own generation. Maybe with one exception that I'll mention in a moment. But I actually think that most of the people that shaped Rabbi Kahana's opinions were people in ancient times, like Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and the way they behaved and the things that they did. I think Rabbi Kahana was heavily influenced by them. Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses, David HaMelech, King David. Rabbi Kahana wrote about all of these people and what they said and what they did and how they reacted. And he believed very strongly that their behavior was timeless, that the things they did were reflective of timeless values that we should also be pursuing similar policies in our generation. So I think he was heavily influenced by people in the Bible, by the great leaders of the Bible. And I think he was heavily influenced also later by great leaders who gave us the Mishnah, the Talmud, people like Rabbi Akiva, people like Maimonides. I think Rabbi Kahana was heavily, heavily influenced by all of them. In his own generation, when he was a boy, I think he was influenced by the Irgun and the Stern Group, the two Jewish freedom fighting organizations that liberated the land of Israel. I think they had a profound impact on him, and we modeled some of our activities and some of our actions in the JDL, in the Jewish Defense League, when I was national chairman and Rabbi Kahana was international chairman. By the way, when I was national chairman of JDL, Rabbi Kahana was the international chairman. And some of the things that we did in our battle to save Soviet Jewry were modeled after the freedom fighting actions of the Irgun and the Stern Group. So the Irgun and the Stern Group influenced Rabbi Kahana as well. He admired the courage of those great freedom fighters who liberated the land of Israel. Two underground freedom fighting organizations there should be a thousand Hollywood movies about the glorious things that they did. And again, if we ever take power in Israel, we're going to make movies, and we're going to, God willing, we'll publicize the things that they did, because it's something that would make every Jew and righteous Gentile proud. And I think Rabbi Kahana was influenced by it. Anyway, thank you, EB. And I want to thank all of our great JTFers for another show that, of course, I love doing. Until next week, Shalom.